want to look at what's happening in Syria, where Latakia, which is pretty much the playground of the president and his generals, is said to be crucial to the outcome of the conflict. The port city, protected by the government's most powerful, the militia, was an unobtainable target till recently, but now the war has reached the doorstep of the regime heartland, and some Syria watchers are of the view that whoever takes over the city will win the civil war. To discuss the significance of Latakia, I'm joined by journalist Charles Glass. Charles is the author of numerous books, including Tribes with Flags, his dramatic journey through Greater Syria. Charles, founder of Charles Glass Books, an imprint of independent London publisher Quartet Books, and he's on the line from, of all places, Poland. Associate Professor Jeremy Salt is from the Department of Political Science at Bilkent University in Ankara. He's the author of The Unmaking of the Middle East, and Jeremy joins us on the line from Ankara, and that line has just dropped out. Charles, the leaders of the Free Syrian Army see the battle in Latakia as the final battle. Oh, hang on, have we lost? We've lost both of them. Heavens above. Well, while we wait to re-establish contact, I had promised, dear listener, to tell you about the hurricane which thumped the farm and just about wiped us out, but that will have to wait until next week because there are more urgent matters and Syria is at the head of the list. Have we got... Sorry? Okay, so Jeremy is there. Okay, first question to you, Jeremy. This is the stronghold of the privileged Alawite sect. Tell me about the Alawite living in Latakia. What sort of a lifestyle do they lead and flaunt?
Well, Latakia itself as a city is quite a pleasant place. It's been modernised and upgraded in the last 20 years. I was there in the 1980s and the beach was absolutely terrible. It's kind of choked with plastic and old shoes, but now you look at it and you see kind of thatched sun umbrellas and, banana lounges and all the rest of it. So it's now a very pleasant place to live. Population is about 50% Sunni Muslim and about 50% Alawi. The hinterland, that includes where Assad's home village of Qardaha is predominantly Alawi, about 70%. For most of the events that have been happening in the last 2 years, Latakia hasn't been deeply involved. Now, of course, we're seeing reports that the armed groups, and particularly Jabhat al-Nusra, are trying to make a push into the mountains in that region, presumably with the intention of trying to take hold of Qardaha.
Why is it so significant, Jeremy? Why does Latakia matter so much?
Well, the whole of Syria matters, really, but Latakia is the traditional stronghold of the Alawis. That's where most of them live. And, of course, that shades over the border into Turkey, and Turkey has a substantial Alawi population, Alawi in Turkey, Alawi in Syria, so there are strong bonds between them. And the thinking, of course, is that if the Syrian government were kind of bowled over, then that region would become the last resort, the last redoubt of the Assad family and the Alawi community. That's why it's important.
I understand that we've now made or renewed contact with Charles. Is that the case? Are you there, Charles?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Would you be kind enough to add your answer to that question about Latakia's significance? Why does it matter so much?
Well, at the moment, it doesn't. The regime doesn't seem to be collapsing. If it were collapsing and Bashar al-Assad decided that he had to retreat somewhere, the Jabal Alawi, which is the hills above Latakia, running all the way up into Turkey, into the Iskenderun Hatay area of Turkey, is an Alawi area, and I suppose if he wanted to survive rather than hold on to the whole country, that's where he would do it, because that's where his people are. But at the moment, I don't think we're anywhere near that.
I understand that the Free Syria Army fighters, or quite a lot of them, grew up there, and they know every rock, every escape route.
I'm sorry, the Free Syrian Army people grew up where?
Around Latakia.
Are you sure you don't mean the Shabiha who are fighting for the regime? Many of them come from Latakia. The Free Syrian Army people, who are mostly, almost all Sunni Muslims, come from everywhere in the country.
Is the terrain very rough there, Charles?
Jebel Alawi, it's called the Alawi Mountain, but it's really more hills. It's not very well covered in trees. It's very gentle, rolling countryside, and probably not that easy to defend.
Jeremy, I understand it's the ancestral home of the president.
Yes, it's true, yes.
Tell me about the family's association with the town, the city.
Well, they're obviously very, very long. This is where the president comes from. This is where his main supporters come from. All the people who support the regime, they come from that region. Of course, I think it's a mistake to say that this is an Alawi government, as the enemies of the Syrian government always do, because over the years, since 1970, Hafez al-Assad was a very very wily and clever person, and he made sure that he kind of involved other groups in government. He gave power, gave a share of power to the Sunnis. He gave it to other kind of religious denominations. So it's simply not kind of a question of the Syrian government being an Alawi government. It's more of a shared government. So the depiction of the government as an Alawi government has always been a main propaganda trope. But, you know, the family's origins in that region go back a long, long time, kind of peasant origins, with Hafez al-Assad kind of being, eventually appearing and being, you know, this very dominant figure in modern Syrian history.
LNL on RN, and my guests are Jeremy Salt from the Department of Political Science at Bilkent University in Ankara, Turkey, and journalist and author Charles Glass. Jeremy, the rebels haven't been able to defeat Assad for 2 years. The horrors mount. At what point can it be imagined there'll be negotiations?
Well, we've reached stalemate. I think from the Turkish point of view, when the Turkish government got involved in this, and when I say the Turkish government, I primarily mean the Prime Minister and the Foreign Minister, I don't really think the Foreign Ministry had much to do with this. It was very much their policy. They made all kinds of predictions about what was going to happen, and none of their predictions turned out to be correct. 2 years later, the army hasn't disintegrated. In fact, if anything, it's perhaps stronger than before. And if anything, there's more social solidarity behind the government than there was before. So we've now reached a definite stalemate, and there's this great division within the Syrian opposition, between the internal Syrian opposition, the external opposition, and I think within the anti-Syrian coalition that calls itself the Friends of the Syrian People. It seems to me that Qatar and Saudi Arabia and Turkey are much more interested in continuing this operation, whereas the Americans seem to be pulling back. And that's partly, I would imagine, as a result of what's happening in North Africa. But having kind of got to this stalemate, it seems that no one yet is ready to retreat and to accept something different. And that would have to be, I guess, what was decided at the Geneva conference last year, which was negotiations without preconditions involving both the government and the opposition.
Charles, will Obama in his second term change policy towards Syria, do you think?
He hasn't given any indication that he's going to change policy from the minor support that he's given to the rebels, the strong vocal support that he's given to them in the sense that, as far as he and his then Secretary of State Hillary Clinton were concerned, the precondition for a settlement was that Bashar al-Assad must go. And he doesn't seem to be backtracking, at least publicly, from that, and it's highly unlikely that he will. In the meantime, in the absence of negotiations that don't prejudge the outcome, Syria will plunge deeper and deeper into civil war.
What about the rest of the Western world? What is there an evolution in their position, given that the regime hasn't fallen, as Jeremy points out, looks reasonably secure?
Well, if I were a policymaker, which I'm not, I would certainly rethink the assumption that began at the outset of the revolution 2 years ago, which was that the regime would crumble very quickly because it was so unpopular. Well, the regime has survived for 2 years. It still controls the main population centers in the country, and it is a very tough nut to crack. So clearly, it's time for a new strategy, and the strategy should be, I believe, and if I were a policymaker, this is what I would put, negotiations through the United Nations for a period of transition along the lines that were discussed in Geneva, which don't prejudge the outcome, that the elections could be won or lost by the regime, probably lost given how unpopular it's becoming because of its attacks on people, but that the election should be the decider of who's going to govern Syria and not the outside supporters of the Free Syrian Army.
I would have, Jeremy, is there a possibility that the Western support or the Western opposition to the president is consolidating his position?
No, I think what's consolidating his position is probably the revelations of the atrocities carried out by the armed groups in Syria. They've come much more to the attention of in the Western media than they had perhaps a year ago. And I think that's what's causing problems amongst the people who are opposing Assad and within the ranks of the governments that are opposing him. I think that's the prime reason they're very disturbed. I mean, to a degree, they've used these groups to try to bring this government down, but now they're facing the spectre or the possibility that maybe they might bring the government down and they might form the government. And various people have said, this raises the possibility of a Taliban-style government in the heart of the Middle East, and they definitely don't want that. So that's part of the kind of the dead end they've reached at the moment, and that's what they need to kind of think about and think about new positions.
Charles, in parenthesis, what are you hearing about Damascus? There's a story that Assad's mother has left Syria.
Well, I'm sceptical of those stories. A year ago, there were stories coming out that Assad himself had fled from Damascus, which turned out not to be true. And I don't see why his mother would leave. She might have left, but I doubt it. The only news that we've had out of the Assad family in the past couple of days is that his wife is pregnant with a baby. But otherwise, the family seems to be pretty much unchanged.
I think
the news I picked up, and probably Charles did as well, was that she was visiting a daughter in the Gulf. That was what it was.
Yeah. So a lot of this is scuttlebutt and exaggerated for, for political or propaganda purposes.
Yes, definitely. Definitely there's a part of the problem in reading the events of the last 2 years is the amount of propaganda that's just been pouring through the media. It's very hard sometimes to work out what's going on.
Charles, the president has made at least one spectacular public appearance and, offered to negotiate it in terms of, constitutional arrangements. Unconvincing?
Well, it was a half-hearted offer because it didn't include the armed opposition. Just as the armed opposition, foolishly probably, won't speak to him, he won't speak to them. And until the two major participants in the war sit down to negotiate an end to the war, the war goes on. It's no good for Bashar al-Assad to say he will discuss with the internal opposition, which is tolerated in Damascus, that he'll discuss it with them, because they don't represent the entire spectrum of the opposition, and certainly not the armed opposition.
To what extent, or how wide is the spectrum of opposition? Is there sufficient cohesion to make them a credible government in waiting?
Well, the term opposition is, in a way, so vague that it includes everyone who's ever opposed the president in Syria.
Yeah.
You have extreme Islamists, you have Free Syrian Army, who themselves are a wide spectrum. You have other militant groups who have taken up arms. You have gangsters and thieves who have taken up arms. You have kidnappers and extortionists who have taken up arms. You also have nonviolent protesters who still don't want to fight, because fighting helps to destroy their country, who want to have peaceful demonstrations and a peaceful transition. And you have Democrats even within the Syrian power structure, within the Syrian parliament, who would like to bring about significant constitutional changes and see the possibility of having a system that could elect new people. So you have everything from solid Democrats to solid Islamists who want to impose Sharia law.
Yeah, so it's pretty chaotic, and it makes what's happening up the road in Egypt look comparatively tranquil.
Well, Egypt, except for occasional riots and some, as we saw in Port Said, killings over a football match, Egypt's revolution was not an armed revolution. The army gave in the face of peaceful protests, and that's what many people in Syria wanted for Syria, but it didn't pan out.
Jeremy, the jihadist group Nusra has links with al-Qaeda. What's their role in all of this?
Well, I think that al-Qaeda, to me anyway, is more or less a trademark. There's no such organization. They're just people who are committed to the ideology of al-Qaeda. and they began flowing into Syria quite early last year, and out of that, their kind of activities developed Jabhat al-Nusra, which is, you know, a fully-fledged group, committed to setting up an Islamic emirate across Syria. So amongst the fighting groups, Jabhat al-Nusra is one of the perhaps the most important, and within its ranks includes many takfiris and jihadis from all over the Muslim world, from Pakistan, from Chechnya, from Iraq, from Libya, from every most countries you can think of. And it's a very very ruthless organization. Some of the worst massacres in Syria over the last 12 months at least, have been committed by this group. And it works in cooperation with other organizations, such as the Free Syrian Army. They all technically cooperate. They might have some differences in outcome, but they work together against the common enemy. And as you know, it's been designated by President Obama as a terrorist organization.
Yeah.
But the thing is that it's leading the fight. And immediately he did that, the head of the new council formed in Doha came back to him and said, look, please don't do this, because they're very important for the struggle. And I think part of the problem here is, just to build on what Charles said before, is that who does the new opposition council formed in Doha represent inside Syria, and who do they control? The main armed groups, 16 of them, signed an agreement saying we don't recognise their authority. So if we were to kind of move towards some kind of negotiations, maybe behind the back door between the Syrian government and other factions, how would they control these people?
Yeah.
Because they're not really responsible to anyone but their own leaders.
Charles, you usefully observe that when the British government and the Irish Republican Army swallowed pride and distaste to negotiate seriously rather than to battle on for an outright victory, the war in Northern Ireland ended. Is that remotely possible in Syria?
I think it's the only viable alternative that will avoid the destruction of the country. If they don't talk, they'll fight, and if they fight, the country goes down and down and down, and more people die, and more people are forced out of the country. The country cannot afford this war.
So, which is more likely to preserve Syria? Its secularism, its economy, healthy relations amongst its communities? I mean, how might it work?
The best way would be for a transition and a coalition of the major representative forces in the country, and those would be the democratic groups and the people who are trying to keep a secular Syria in which Alawites and Shiites and Christians and Armenians and Kurds all have a place and don't feel excluded. And I think that's the only way forward for Syria. And also, from my own many trips to Syria, both before and during this revolution, it seems to me that's what most Syrians want. When the violence starts, then positions become more extreme on both sides, and things that people didn't even think of before suddenly become dominant in the discourse. It would be better to disarm this entire conflict so that more reasoned voices could come forward again.
And the role of the outside world in this process, Charles, is what, or should be what?
Well, at the moment, it's been arming the Syrian opposition by most of the world, and then arming the regime by the Russians, and supporting the regime, support for the regime from Iran and to a lesser extent Iraq. But what those people should be doing is talking amongst themselves about ways in which they could bring all the Syrian parties to the table. So the Russians bring the regime to the table, the Turks, the Saudis, the Qataris, the Americans, and the Europeans bring the opposition to the table, and that there'll be international guarantees for a settlement.
Jeremy, President Assad has said that his army could win the conflict if Turkey stopped its support for the insurgents. Has Ankara reacted to that?
Actually, the government here has been very quiet recently. I mean, I think they've realised that their policies come to a dead end, but they don't know what to do now. Now, Erdogan, the Prime Minister, is in Qatar tomorrow, and I imagine he definitely will be discussing Syria and what they're going to do now. I'm not quite sure to what degree the jihadis are now present in southeastern Turkey. Definitely they were there in large numbers a year ago, to the discontent of the local people. Most of them now seem to be inside Syria, but obviously they can cross back across the border if they need. So I think the Turkish government has realised that its policy has ended in a mess, but it doesn't really quite know what to do now. And inside this country, it's not this confrontation or this confrontation with the Syrian government is not popular. I mean, the Turkish people are not up for armed intervention in Syria, and I don't think possibly they realise how deeply Turkey already is involved.
Gentlemen, I thank you. Journalist Charles Glass is the author of numerous books, including Tribes with Flags, a dangerous passage through the chaos of the Middle East, which is being republished by HarperCollins. Jeremy Salt, Associate Professor of the Department of Political Science at Bilkent University in Ankara, in Turkey. Jeremy is the author of The Unmaking of the Middle East, a history of Western disorder in Arab lands, and that's published by the University of California Press. And after a little bit of music, we're going to look at the cultural values embodied in maps, and some very odd maps indeed. Ellie Nell on RN.